I like his work actually quite a bit. And there was Don B. Griffiths. He became Dominican monk, and then eventually went to India and became sort of a Indian Swami as well, simultaneously. He was also part of this group. Dorothy Sayers, the mystery novelist, she was loosely part of the group, I think, as well. And then finally, last but not least, it's Owen Barfield. He and Tolkien and Lewis actually were sort of part of the original circle that grew into the Inklings. And he was this very unique philosopher of language. And all of the Inklings, I think, were united in a sort of common quest, which was nothing short of this, the destruction of scientific materialism is the dominant way of thinking, right? And at the time, it must have seemed a completely quixotic thing to try to do, because if you know anything about the mid-20th century, especially in England, English-speaking world, I mean, it was a period where scientific materialism, scientism was overwhelmingly the dominant way of thinking about things. And to try to dredge up Plato and Aristotle and Aquinas and all this other stuff at that time seemed hopeless. But the group of them thought, no, we can actually do it. Or at least we can try. And I think it's really remarkable how successful they were. I mean, we live in a very different world now than what they lived in. And to some extent, it's because of their work that we do, I think, ultimately. So Tolkien was really encouraged to make his fiction public, to keep working on it, because the others saw this as an essential part of this project, right, of defeating that kind of materialism. So I want to be careful, though, to make sure that I'm not misconstruing or misrepresenting Tolkien, because if we brought Tolkien back here and said, yeah, you're using your books to propagate a particular philosophy, he would have said, no, that's not right at all. I'm an artist, right? I'm doing this for the sake of the art. And that's true, right? So, but in his case, so I think I'll try to argue, I'm not claiming that he sort of prostituted his art in order to promote a particular political or philosophical end, right? But in this case, in Tolkien's case, the philosophy that we're talking about is incorporated into the story and the characters and the world itself, right? So by being faithful to his vision of this world and being the kind of artist that he was propagating this philosophy as well, right? Not as an extraneous end, but just in the very act of being creative in this way. And the others, I think, encouraged him to say, yes, that's important, keep doing it, right? Not just for the sake of the art, but for the sake of the larger impact, right? So again, I'll contrast Tolkien with someone like Ayn Rand, let's say, where, you know, if you're a Rand fan, I apologize, but you know, in Rand's novels, that sometimes the action will just stop and you get a lecture on Randian philosophy, right, in the middle of it. And that never happens in Lord of the Rings, right? Gandalf never stops the action and says, okay, let me tell you about Plato, right? there are no philosophical discussions of that kind. Instead, the philosophical content is sublimated into the text, into the story itself, into the plot, into the characters, and so on. So that's my second or third claim. So as I said, I don't think anyone except Plato himself has been able to do this as well as Tolkien did. And I personally see Tolkien and Lewis as playing a crucial role here. So, I mean, Lewis has also, of course, wrote a lot of really great fiction, but he certainly was good at the philosophical argumentation, dialectical side of things, right? And Tolkien excelled at the mythical side. And so my claim is that the two together were much more effective than either one would have been individually. Right? So you get the philosophical argument if you need that, but you also get the mythical elevation of the imagination that Tolkien provides. So I'd say without Lewis's dialectic, the myth would have been barren, but without the myth, Lewis's dialectic would have been powerless. So they work together, I think, in a unique sort of way. Now, 20th century philosophy has tended to, okay, I've already covered this, has tended to emphasize logic to a very high degree, and I'm basically trained as a logician myself, so I have a professional bias in that direction. But I think that we can certainly overemphasize this. I mean, logic suffers from the GIGO principle, right? Garbage in, garbage out, right? Your conclusions are only as good as your premises, no matter how clever your logic is. And so the question is, where do we get the right premises in the first place? How do we get in touch with the reality so that we can apply logic to it and get the right conclusions? And Heidegger argued that we should listen to the poet. And I think there's something true about that poetry, good poetry, including good mythopoeia, the kind that Tolkien provides us with, is something that enables us to grasp reality in a way that then provides us with those premises we need to do good philosophy. So there's a famous conversation. As you may know, Lewis, when Tolkien and Lewis first met, Lewis was an atheist, but they shared a love for myth, especially for sort of northern Scandinavian kinds of myths. And there's a famous conversation that Tolkien and Lewis had in Magdalen College right before Lewis converted, where Lewis says, let's see if I have a slide for that. Yeah, Lewis says, well, myths are lies and therefore worthless, even though breathed through silver. So they're beautiful, right? They're breathed through silver. I love them. But intellectually, they're lies. Right? They're not true, right? And Tolkien responded, this is not his word for word, this is my paraphrase of Tolkien, that myths are not lies, they're the best way of conveying certain truths that are otherwise inexpressible. Right? So the myths we create contain a splintered fragment of the true light. So, and eventually Lewis comes around to seeing that this is right. So this sort of backs up my third claim. But I wanted to get to the fourth claim, one that philosophical theory guided Tolkien in transmuting his philosophy into art. And this is where Barfield comes into play. So Barfield, in a conversation, Tolkien had a conversation with Lewis in 1928, I think, where he'd gone to an early lecture by Barfield, and he said the lecture had changed my whole outlook. So it had a huge impact on him in 1928. And the thing that impressed him was an idea that Barfield had, which he called ancient semantic unities. So it's going to be a little bit technical for the next few minutes. I want to sort of immerse you in a little bit of Barfield's philosophy, because I think it's important in understanding what made Tolkien tick, how he ended up with the kind of thing that he did. So this is the book that lecture eventually evolved into. It's called Poetic Diction by Owen Barfield. And what Barfield was saying is that he used the word spirit as an example of what he means by an ancient semantic unity. So in a lot of languages, Greek, Latin, Hebrew, and other ancient languages, the word spirit can mean wind, it can mean breath, and it can mean some kind of, you know, supernatural, intellectual, or spiritual, agency. And so Barfield, at the time, was reacting against a particular theory of language that we might call a naturalistic theory of language. And on this view, the original meaning spirit was something like wind or breath, maybe something physical, right? And then at some point, someone invents a kind of metaphor and uses it to refer to some further dimension of life, right? And Barfield points out that if that were true, then you would expect that as you look through the history of language, that you'd find it getting less and less metaphorical the farther back you got. It would be more and more physical and naturalistic. And in fact, that's not what anthropologists find at all. They find the opposite, right? The language actually becoming less naturalistic and physicalistic and more evocative and metaphorical as you go further back. And so there's something wrong with this naturalistic theory. So Barfield offers an alternative view, which is that the word spirit doesn't actually have three distinct meanings. There's really just one meaning there, right? And because there's a something that's really unifying spirit, wind, and spirit in the further sense, right? There's a real Platonic form, so to speak, that stands behind all these phenomena, which the original word was getting at. And what we've done in the modern way of thinking is we've broken up that original meaning into these three separate distinct meanings. So we're taking something that's ordinary, that was originally unified, and we're dividing it, breaking it up. And we're breaking it up from the point of view of being able to manipulate reality for our own purposes. So it's a turn towards a pragmatic utilitarian approach to the world that creates this fragmentation of the original unity that was there. Right? So let's see. Yeah, so let me tie this in with the distinction between, okay, so scientific progress, yeah. So scientific progress involves our narrowing and specializing meanings in order to control nature more effectively. So where we start with this unified meaning, we break it up into narrower, more specialized meanings, right? And that does help us to control nature, but it comes at a cost. It obscures some of these real unities between mind and body, cause and meaning, particular universal, and so on. The scientific discourse divides and treats as mere metaphors. So there's a kind of a loss there. So another distinction that a very closely related distinction that Barfield makes is between myth and allegory. So a myth is a story that communicates some kind of truth to us through the imagination. Okay? So understanding the myth, according to Barfield, increases our understanding of the real world. And the way it does that is by reawakening and strengthening this more primitive, unitive way of thinking, these ancient semantic unities. It says that myths are constituted by what he calls a unity of percepts. So in other words, there's a single thing in reality that we're perceiving, and the myth is presenting that unity to us through the story. In contrast, an allegory is something that's a story that doesn't really make sense in its own terms, right? Every part of the allegory really stands for something else. And you don't understand what the story's about until you figure out what the secret decoder ring is, that you can decode the story back into its original meanings, right? So, a good example would be something like Pilgrim's Progress, where, you know, you don't really understand what's going on until you say, okay, this represents, you know, lust or something like that. Now I can figure out what it means, right? So that, in that case, the story is unified by what he calls a synthesis of concepts or ideas. So it's not that there's a single thing that's unifying the story. It's rather a kind of artificial correspondence that we create, where we push these ideas together, right? So we've got a swamp, we've got lust, we sort of jam them together to make the allegory work, right? Tolkien picks this up, and Tolkien, whenever anybody says that anything Lord of the Rings is allegorical, he says, no, it's not, I hate allegory. Nothing allegorical in my work at all. That is, you know, don't think, oh, Gandalf stands for Christ or an angel or whatever. Don't think that, right? Just, you know, understand the story in its own terms, right? And that will communicate some further truth to you, yes, but not in an allegorical sort of way, is the point. Now, Barfield also suggests, yeah, so this is the idea of sub-creation, right? He creates a whole world, right? It's important so that somebody can read Tolkien and enjoy Tolkien and have no idea that there's a kind of deeper philosophical point to it, right? And that's crucial for Tolkien, right? It's not that you have to figure out that deeper philosophical point in order to make sense of the story. The story stands on its own. Because it lives within a world that's complete and that's rational and that sort of makes sense. So Barfield has this distinction between two modes of consciousness. He calls prosaic and poetic. Prosaic meaning prosy, and poetic obviously meaning poetic or mythical. And so the prosaic is pragmatic, utilitarian. We try to gain control over things. There's a rigid subject-object dichotomy. So there's me and the world. It always distinguishes and differentiates things, and it analyzes things into parts. And then if it unifies things, it unifies them through its own artificial concepts, right? Whereas the poetic consciousness is more contemplative rather than pragmatic, right? Just sort of taking in reality. It's seeking to participate in the world rather than control it. Doesn't really have a strict separation between subject and object. It perceives real unities in nature rather than distinguishing things, grasps wholes, perceives unities through the imagination rather than through artificial concepts. And what Barfield and Tolkien, I think, both agree on is that as a result of the scientific revolution, we've become unbalanced, where our thinking is almost entirely prosaic, and we've lost this more poetic way of relating to the world. And so one of the things that the Lord of the Rings and the other works are trying to do is to revive the poetic mode of consciousness, so to speak, within us. Light is another great example of this. So, again, if you think about the language of light naturalistically, you might think, well, really, light refers to electromagnetic radiation, right? And then you can apply that metaphorically to refer to intellectual illumination or maybe to spiritual enlightenment or something like that, but those are just metaphors, right? Barfield and Tolkien, I think, would be saying, no, there's actually a real unity between these kinds of light, right? Spiritual light is a light, just like light is light. This poetic way of understanding things is getting at something really important. And once you grasp that, then suddenly you see, why does Tolkien use light and darkness so often in his works, right? So, you know, if he were writing an allegory, you'd expect him to produce lots and lots and lots of different metaphors, so to speak, lots and lots of different correspondences. But instead, you find him just using light and darkness, light and darkness, light and darkness, light and darkness, like over and over and over again in all these different manifestations, right? And that's enabling us to grasp this idea that, yeah, light in the world of Middle Earth is also a spiritual force. It's a moral force. It's something more than just natural, right? And that's, if we grasp that, then we see that that's in a sense true in our world too, is the thought. So we see this, you know, again, light, reason, truth, goodness, being, these things are all interconnected in Tolkien, right? And it's only our prosaic mind that kind of separates them, right? So I'll skip over that as well. Barfield's theory, again, influenced Tolkien's way of approaching these things. Here's another aspect of this. From Barfield, Tolkien got the idea that through his works, he really wanted us to recapture the way of thinking and relating to the world that people in the Dark Ages would have had, right? So what would it have been like to be an Anglo-Saxon around the hearth, fire hearth, you know, in the 8th century AD? What would it be like to relate to the world in that way? He wants to recreate for us that same experience. And one of the things that he did was, he was an expert on these subjects. He knew the fragmentary evidence we have of what people were actually thinking about and doing during that period. And so he tries to reconstruct from those materials the actual language of the Dark Ages. Right? So many of the things, like almost all the elements that you find in The Lord of the Rings, orcs, dwarves, elves, both light and dark elves, the Silmarils, the Ents, the Wraiths, the Valar, the Blessed Realm, and so on, all of these things are attested to in actual literature of that period, right? So he's interpolating between these bits of information, much as linguists would do if they try to reconstruct the Indo-European language, right? There are no actual records of it, but there are vestiges of it that they can use to reconstruct what the language must have been like. That's really what Tolkien set out to do, was to reconstruct the actual mythology of that Anglo-Saxon period. And so by immersing us in that, he's hoping that we will be able to adjust our thinking and enrich our thinking in that way. Okay, so I'm going to skip over this because I already talked about it. This is the idea of asterisk objects. So in the Indo-European, as they reconstruct these roots, they will put asterisks on them to say, we don't actually have any records of this, but we believe this is what they did. And so the characters, landscapes, races, stories, and so on that Tolkien puts into his works are sort of asterisk objects. That is, they're reconstructions of the actual elements of the Dark Ages in various ways. So we're trying to recapture this poetic mind. So this also happens in two further ways, I think. One way is that the characters in the story, they embody this more poetic way of thinking, right? So not only is the story being presented to us poetically, the characters themselves relate to the world poetically, right? So you don't have a lot of inner monologue, right? You don't have sort of existential angst or something like that appearing, right? The good characters like Aragorn and Frodo and so on, they're fully identified with their place in the world, right? They're not alienated from their conditions, right? They don't have that subject-object dichotomy that we're used to. So that happens. Secondly, the elves themselves are crucial because the elves exercise what's called enchantment, right? That is, they use song and story to change the consciousness of the hobbits, right? So when the hobbits go to visit Galadriel, there's like they're living in a song, is the way he's handling it.